chapter 16, of the literary labors of the two Apollinaires and the emperor's prohibition of Christians being instructed in Greek literature. The imperial law, one which forbade Christians to study Greek literature, rendered the two Apollinaires of whom we have above spoken much more distinguished than before, for both being skilled in polite learning, the father as a grammarian, and the son as a rhetorician, they made themselves serviceable to the Christians at this crisis. For the former, as a grammarian, composed a grammar consistent with the Christian faith. He also translated the books of Moses into heroic verse, and paraphrased all the historical books of the Old Testament, putting them partly into dactylic measure, and partly reducing them to the form of dramatic tragedy. He purposely employed all kinds of verse, that no form of expression peculiar to the Greek language might be unknown or unheard of amongst Christians. The younger Apollinaires, who was well trained in eloquence, expounded the Gospels and apostolic doctrines in the way of dialogue, as Plato among the Greeks had done. Thus showing themselves useful to the Christian cause, they overcame the subtlety of the emperor through their own labors. But divine providence was more potent than either their labors, or the craft of the emperor, for not long afterwards, in the manner we shall hereafter explain, to the law became wholly inoperative, and the works of these men are now of no greater importance than if they had never been written. But perhaps someone will vigorously reply, saying, on what grounds do you affirm that both these things were effected by the providence of God? That the emperor's sudden death was very advantageous to Christianity is indeed evident, but surely the rejection of the Christian compositions of the two Apollinaires, and the Christians beginning afresh to imbue their minds with the philosophy of the heathens, this works out no benefit to Christianity, for pagan philosophy teaches polytheism, and is injurious to the promotion of true religion. This objection I shall meet with such considerations as at present occur to me. Greek literature certainly was never recognized either by Christ or his apostles as divinely inspired, nor on the other hand was it wholly rejected as pernicious. And this they did, I conceive, not inconsiderately. For there were many philosophers among the Greeks who were not far from the knowledge of God, and in fact these, being disciplined by logical science, strenuously opposed the Epicureans and other contentious sophists who denied divine providence, confuting their ignorance. And for these reasons they have become useful to all lovers of real piety. Nevertheless, they themselves were not acquainted with the head of true religion, being ignorant of the mystery of Christ which had been hidden from generations and ages. 3. And that this was so, the apostle in his epistle to the Romans thus declares, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, that they may be without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. From these words it appears that they had the knowledge of truth, which God had manifested to them, but were guilty on this account, that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. Wherefore, by not forbidding the study of the learned works of the Greeks, they left it to the discretion of those who wished to do so. This is our first argument in defense of the position we took. Another may be thus put: the divinely inspired scriptures undoubtedly inculcate doctrines that are both admirable in themselves, and heavenly in their character. They also eminently tend to produce piety and integrity of life in those who are guided by their precepts, pointing out a walk of faith which is highly approved of God. But they do not instruct us in the art of reasoning, by means of which we may be enabled successfully to resist those who oppose the truth. Besides, adversaries are most easily foiled when we can use their own weapons against them. But this power was not supplied to Christians by the writings of the Apollinaires. Julian had this in mind when he by law prohibited Christians from being educated in Greek literature, for he knew very well that the fables it contains would expose the whole pagan system, of which he had become the champion, to ridicule and contempt. Even Socrates, the most celebrated of their philosophers, despised these absurdities, and was condemned on account of it, as if he had attempted to violate the sanctity of their deities. Moreover, both Christ and his apostle enjoin us to become discriminating money changers, 5 so that we might prove all things, and hold fast that which is good, 6 directing us also to beware lest anyone should spoil us through philosophy and vain deceit. 7 But this we cannot do, unless we possess ourselves of the weapons of our adversaries, taking care that in making this acquisition we do not adopt their sentiments, but testing them, reject the evil, but retain all that is good and true, for good wherever it is found, is a property of truth. Should anyone imagine that in making these assertions we wrest the scriptures from their legitimate construction, let it be remembered that the apostle not only does not forbid our being instructed in Greek learning, but that he himself seems by no means to have neglected it, inasmuch as he knows many of the sayings of the Greeks. Whence did he get the saying, "The Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, slow bellies"? 8 But from a perusal of the oracles of Epimenides, 9 The Cretan initiator. Or how would he have known this, for we are also his offspring, 10 Had he not been acquainted with the phenomena of Aratus, 11 The astronomer. Again this sentence, "Evil communications corrupt good manners," 12 is a sufficient proof that he was conversant with the tragedies of Euripides. 13 But what need is there of enlarging on this point? It is well known that in ancient times the doctors of the church by unhindered usage were accustomed to exercise themselves in the learning of the Greeks, until they had reached an advanced age. This they did with a view to improve themselves in eloquence and to strengthen and polish their mind, and at the same time to enable them to refute the errors of the heathen. Let these remarks be sufficient in the subject suggested by the two Apollinaires. Chapter 17, the emperor preparing an expedition against the Persians, arrives at Antioch, and being ridiculed by the inhabitants, he retorts on them by a satirical publication entitled Misopogon, or The Beard Hater. The emperor having extorted immense sums of money from the Christians, hastening his expedition against the Persians, arrived at Antioch in Syria. There, desiring to show the citizens how much he affected glory, he unduly depressed the prices of commodities, neither taking into account the circumstances of that time, nor reflecting how much the presence of an army inconveniences the population of the provinces, and of necessity lessens the supply of provisions to the cities. The merchants and retailers one therefore left off trading, being unable to sustain the losses which the imperial edict entailed upon them. Consequently the necessaries failed. The Antiochians not bearing the insult, dash for they are a people naturally impatient with insult, instantly broke forth into invectives against Julian, caricaturing his beard also, which was a very long one, and saying that it ought to be cut off and manufactured into ropes. They added that the bull which was impressed upon his coin was a symbol of his having desolated the world. For the emperor, being excessively superstitious, was continually sacrificing bulls too on the altars of his idols, and had ordered the impression of a bull and altar to be made on his coin. Irritated by these scoffs, he threatened to punish the city of Antioch, and returned to Tarsus in Cilicia, giving orders that preparations should be made for his speedy departure thence. Whence Libanius the sophist took occasion to compose 2 orations, one addressed to the emperor in behalf of the Antiochians, the other to the inhabitants of Antioch on the emperor's displeasure. It is however affirmed that these compositions were merely written, and never recited in public. Julian, abandoning his former purpose of revenging himself on his satirists by injurious deeds, expended his wrath in reciprocating their abusive taunts, for he wrote a pamphlet against them which he entitled Antiochicus, or Misopogon, thus leaving an indelible stigma upon that city and its inhabitants. But we must now speak of the evils which he brought upon the Christians at Antioch. Chapter 18, the emperor consulting an oracle, the demon gives no response, being awed by the nearness of Babylus the martyr. Having ordered that the pagan temples at Antioch should be opened, he was very eager to obtain an oracle from Apollo of Daphne, but the demon that inhabited the temple remained silent through fear of his neighbor, Babylus I the martyr, for the coffin which contained the body of that saint was close by. When the emperor was informed of this circumstance, He commanded that the coffin should be immediately removed, upon which the Christians of Antioch, including women and children, transported the coffin from Daphne to the city, with solemn rejoicings and chanting of psalms. The Psalms 20 were such as cast reproach on the gods of the heathen, and those who put confidence in them and their images. Chapter 19, Wrath of the Emperor, and Firmness of Theodore the Confessor. Then indeed the emperor's real temper and disposition, which he had hitherto kept as much as possible from observation, became fully manifested, for he who had boasted so much of his philosophy, was no longer able to restrain himself. But being goaded almost to madness by these reproachful hymns, he was ready to inflict the same cruelties on the Christians, with which Diocletian's agents had formerly visited them. Since, however, his solicitude about the Persian expedition afforded him no leisure for personally executing his wishes, he commanded Sallust the Praetorian prefect to seize those who had been most conspicuous for their zeal in psalm singing, in order to make examples of them. The prefect, though a pagan, was far from being pleased with his commission, but since he durst not contravene it, he caused several of the Christians to be apprehended, and some of them to be imprisoned. One young man named Theodore, whom the heathens brought before him, he subjected to a variety of tortures, causing his person to be so lacerated, and only released him from further punishment when he thought that he could not possibly outlive the torments. Yet God preserved this sufferer, so that he long survived that confession. Rufinus, the author of the ecclesiastical history written in Latin, states that he himself conversed with the same Theodore a considerable time afterwards, and inquired of him whether in the process of scourging and racking he had not felt the most intense pains. His answer was, that he felt the pain of the tortures to which he was subjected for a very short time, and that a young man stood by him who both wiped off the sweat which was produced by the acuteness of the ordeal through which he was passing, and at the same time strengthened his mind, so that he rendered this time of trial a season of rapture rather than of suffering. Let this suffice concerning the most wonderful Theodore. About this time Persian ambassadors came to the emperor, requesting him to terminate the war on certain express conditions. But Julian abruptly dismissed them, saying, "You shall very shortly see me in person, so that there will be no need of an embassy." Chapter 20, The Jews instigated by the emperor attempt to rebuild their temple, and are frustrated in their attempt by miraculous interposition. The emperor in another attempt to molest the Christians exposed his superstition. Being fond of sacrificing, he not only himself delighted in the blood of victims, but considered it an indignity offered to him, if others did not do likewise. And as he found but few persons of this stamp, he sent for the Jews and inquired of them why they abstained from sacrificing, since the law of Moses enjoined it. On their replying that it was not permitted them to do this in any other place than Jerusalem, he immediately ordered them to rebuild Solomon's temple. Meanwhile, he himself proceeded on his expedition against the Persians. The Jews, who had been long desirous of obtaining a favorable opportunity for rearing their temple afresh in order that they might therein offer sacrifice, applied themselves very vigorously to the work. Moreover, they conducted themselves with great insolence toward the Christians, and threatened to do them as much mischief as they had themselves suffered from the Romans. The emperor, having ordered that the expenses of this structure should be defrayed out of the public treasury, all things were soon provided, such as timber and stone, burnt brick, clay, lime, and all other materials necessary for building. On this occasion Cyril, bishop of Jerusalem, called to mind the prophecy of Daniel, which Christ also in the Holy Gospels has confirmed, and predicted in the presence of many persons, that the time had indeed come in which one stone should not be left upon another in that temple, but that the Saviour's prophetic declaration one should have its full accomplishment. Such were the bishop's words, and on the night following, a mighty earthquake tore up the stones of the old foundations of the temple and dispersed them all together with the adjacent edifices. Terror consequently possessed the Jews on account of the event, and the report of it brought many to the spot who resided at a great distance. When therefore a vast multitude was assembled, another prodigy took place. Fire came down from heaven and consumed all the builders' tools, so that the flames were seen preying upon mallets, irons to smooth and polish stones, saws, hatchets, adzes, in short all the various implements which the workman had procured as necessary for the undertaking, and the fire continued burning among these for a whole day. The Jews indeed were in the greatest possible alarm, and unwillingly confessed Christ, calling him God, yet they did not do his will, but influenced by inveterate prepossessions they still clung to Judaism. Even a third miracle which afterwards happened failed to lead them to a belief of the truth. For the next night luminous impressions of a cross appeared imprinted on their garments, which at daybreak they in vain attempted to rub or wash out. They were therefore blinded, as the apostle says, too, and cast away the good which they had in their hands, and thus was the temple, instead of being rebuilt, at that time wholly overthrown. Chapter 21. The Emperor's Invasion of Persia, and Death. The Emperor meanwhile invaded the country of the Persians a little before spring, having learned that the races of Persia were greatly enfeebled and totally spiritless in winter. For from their inability to endure cold, they abstain from military service at that season, and it has become a proverb that a Mede will not then draw his hand from underneath his cloak. And well knowing that the Romans were inured to brave all the rigors of the atmosphere, he let them loose on the country. After devastating a considerable tract of country, including numerous villages and fortresses, they next assailed the cities, and having invested the great city Ctesiphon, he reduced the king of the Persians to such straits that the latter sent repeated embassies to the emperor, offering to surrender a portion of his dominions, on condition of his quitting the country, and putting an end to the war. But Julian was unaffected by these submissions, and showed no compassion to a suppliant foe, nor did he think of the adage, "To conquer is honorable, but to be more than conqueror gives occasion for envy." Giving credit to the divinations of the philosopher Maximus, with whom he was in continual intercourse, he was deluded into the belief that his exploits would not only equal, but exceed those of Alexander of Macedon, so that he spurned with contempt the entreaties of the Persian monarch. He even supposed, in accordance with the teachings of Pythagoras and Plato on the transmigration of souls, one, that he was possessed of Alexander's soul, or rather that he himself was Alexander in another body. This ridiculous fancy deluded and caused him to reject the negotiations for peace proposed by the king of the Persians. Wherefore the latter, convinced of the uselessness of them, was constrained to prepare for conflict, and therefore on the next day after the rejection of his embassy, he drew out in order of battle all the forces he had. The Romans indeed censured their prince, for not avoiding an engagement when he might have done so with advantage. Nevertheless they attacked those who opposed them, and again put the enemy to flight. The emperor was present on horseback, and encouraged his soldiers in battle, but confiding simply in his hope of success, he wore no armor. In this defenseless state, a dart cast by someone unknown pierced through his arm and entered his side, making a wound. In consequence of this wound he died. Some say that a certain Persian hurled the javelin, and then fled. Others assert that one of his own men was the author of the deed, which indeed is the best corroborated and most current report. But Caestus, one of his bodyguards, who celebrated this emperor's deeds in heroic verse, says in narrating the particulars of this war, that the wound of which he died was inflicted by a demon. This is possibly a mere poetical fiction, or perhaps it was really the fact, for vengeful furies have undoubtedly destroyed many persons. Be the case however as it may, this is certain, that the ardor of his natural temperament rendered him incautious, his learning made him vain, and his affectation of clemency exposed him to contempt. Thus Julian ended his life in Persia, to, as we have said, in his fourth consulate, three which he bore with Sallust his colleague. This event occurred on the 26th of June, in the third year of his reign, and the seventh from his having been created Caesar by Constantius, he being at that time in the 31st year of his age. Chapter 22. Jovian is proclaimed emperor. The soldiery being thrown into extreme perplexity by an event so unexpected, and without delay, on the following day proclaimed Jovian emperor, a person alike distinguished for his courage and birth. He was a military tribune when Julian put forth an edict giving his officers the option of either sacrificing or resigning their rank in the army, and chose rather to lay down his commission, one than to obey the mandate of an impious prince. Julian, however, being pressed by the urgency of the war which was before him, retained him among his generals. On being saluted emperor, he positively declined to accept the sovereign power, and when the soldiers brought him forward by force, he declared that being a Christian, he did not wish to reign over a people who chose to adopt paganism as their religion. They all then with one voice answered that they also were Christians, upon which he accepted the imperial dignity, perceiving himself suddenly left in very difficult circumstances, in the midst of the Persian territory, where his army was in danger of perishing for want of necessaries. He agreed to terminate the war, even on terms by no means honorable to the glory of the Roman name, but rendered necessary by the exigencies of the crisis. Submitting therefore to the loss of the government of Syria, too, and giving up also Nisibis, a city of Mesopotamia, he withdrew from their territories. The announcement of these things gave fresh hope to the Christians, while the pagans vehemently bewailed Julian's death. Nevertheless, the whole army reprobated his intemperate heat, and ascribed to his rashness in listening to the wily reports of a Persian deserter, the humiliation of ceding the territories lost, for being imposed upon by the statements of this fugitive, he was induced to burn the ships which supplied them with provisions by water, by which means they were exposed to all the horrors of famine. Then also Libanius composed a funeral oration on him, which he designated Julinus, or Epitaph, wherein he celebrates with lofty encomiums almost all his actions. But in referring to the books which Julian wrote against the Christians, he says that he has therein clearly demonstrated the ridiculous and trifling character of their sacred books. Had this sophist contented himself with extolling the emperor's other acts, I should have quietly proceeded with the course of my history. But since this famous rhetorician has thought proper to take occasion to inveigh against the scriptures of the Christian faith, we also propose to pause a little and in a brief review consider his words. Chapter 23. Refutation of what Libanius the sophist said concerning Julian. When the winter, says he, one had lengthened the nights, the emperor made an attack on those books which made the man of Palestine both God, and the Son of God, and by a long series of arguments having proved that these writings, which are so much revered by Christians, are ridiculous and unfounded, he has evinced himself wiser and more skillful than the Tyrian too old man. But may this Tyrian sage be propitious to me, and mildly bear with what has been affirmed, seeing that he has been excelled by his son. Such is the language of Libanius the sophist. But I confess, indeed, that he was an excellent rhetorician, but am persuaded that had he not coincided with the emperor in religious sentiment, he would not only have given expression to all that has been said against him by Christians, but would have magnified every ground of censure as naturally becomes a rhetorician. For while Constantius was alive he wrote encomiums upon him, but after his death he brought the most insulting and reproachful charges against him. So that if Porphyry had been emperor, Libanius would certainly have preferred his books to Julian's, and had Julian been a mere sophist, he would have termed him a very indifferent one, as he does Aespolius in his epitaph upon Julian. Since then he has spoken in the spirit of a pagan, a sophist, and the friend of him whom he lauded, we shall endeavour to meet what he has advanced, as far as we are able. In the first place he says that the emperor undertook to attack these books during the long winter nights. Now to attack means to make the writing of a confutation of them a task, as the sophists commonly do in teaching the rudiments of their art, for he had perused these books long before, but attacked them at this time. But throughout the long contest into which he entered, instead of attempting to disprove anything by sound reasoning, as Libanius asserts, in the absence of truth he had recourse to sneers and contemptuous jests, of which he was excessively fond, and thus he sought to hold up to derision what is too firmly established to be overthrown. For every one who enters into controversy with another, sometimes trying to pervert the truth, and at others to conceal it, falsities by every possible means the position of his antagonist, and an adversary is not satisfied with doing malignant acts against one with whom he is at variance, but will speak against him also, and charge upon the object of his dislike the very faults he is conscious of in himself. That both Julian and Porphyry, whom Libanius calls the Tyrian old man, took great delight in scoffing, is evident from their own works. For Porphyry in his History of the Philosophers has treated with ridicule the life of Socrates, the most eminent of all the philosophers, making such remarks on him as neither Miletus, nor Anytus, his accusers, would have dared to utter. Of Socrates, I say, who is admired by all the Greeks for his modesty, justice, and other virtues, whom Plato, three the most admirable among them, Xenophon, and the rest of the philosophic band, not only honor as one beloved of God, but also are accustomed to think of as having been endowed with superhuman intelligence. And Julian, imitating his father, displayed a like morbidness of mind in his book, entitled The Caesars, wherein he traduces all his imperial predecessors, not sparing even Mark the philosopher. For their own writings therefore show that they both took pleasure in taunts and reviling, and I have no need of profuse and clever expressions to do this, but what has been said is enough concerning their mood in this respect. Now I write these things, using the oration of each as witnesses respecting their dispositions, but of Julian in particular, what Gregory of Nazianzus 5 says in his second oration against the pagans is in the following terms: "These things were made evident to others by experience, after the possession of imperial authority had left him free to follow the bent of his inclinations, but I had foreseen it all, from the time I became acquainted with him at Athens. Thither he came, by permission of the emperor, soon after the change in his brother's fortune. His motive for this visit was twofold. One reason was honorable to him, viz., to see Greece, and attend the schools there. The other was a more secret one, which few knew anything about, for his impiety had not yet presumed to openly avow itself, viz., to have opportunity of consulting the sacrificers and other impostors respecting his own destiny. I well remember that even then I was no bad diviner concerning this person, although I by no means pretend to be one of those skilled in the art of divination, but the fickleness of his disposition, and the incredible extravagancy of his mind, rendered me prophetic, if indeed he is the best prophet who conjectures correctly six events. For it seemed to me that no good was portended by an ex seldom steady, the frequent shrugging of shoulders, an eye scowling and always in motion, together with a frenzied aspect, a gait irregular and tottering, a nose breathing only contempt and insult, with ridiculous contortions of countenance expressive of the same thing, immoderate and very loud laughter, nods as it were of assent, and drawings back of the head as if in denial, without any visible cause, speech with hesitancy and interrupted by his breathing, disorderly and senseless questions, answers no better, all jumbled together without the least consistency or method. Why need I enter into minute particulars? Such I foresaw he would be beforehand, as I found him afterwards from experience. And if any of those who were then present and heard me were now here, they would readily testify that when I observed these prognostics I exclaimed, 'Ah, how great a mischief to itself is the Roman Empire fostering!' And that when I had uttered these words I prayed God that I might be a false prophet, for it would have been far better that I should have been convicted of having formed an erroneous judgment, than that the world should be filled with so many calamities, and that such a monster should have appeared as never before had been seen. Although many deluges and conflagrations are recorded, many earthquakes and chasms, and descriptions are given of many ferocious and inhuman men, as well as prodigies of the brute creation, compounded of different races, of which nature produced unusual forms, his end has indeed been such as corresponds with the madness of his career. This is the sketch which Gregory has given us of Julian. Moreover, that in their various compilations they have endeavored to do violence to the truth, sometimes by the corruption of passages of sacred scripture, at others by either adding to the express words, and putting such a construction upon them as suited their own purpose, many have demonstrated, by confuting their cavils, and exposing their fallacies. Origen in particular, who lived long before Julian's time, by himself raising objections to such passages of Holy Scripture 7 as seemed to disturb some readers, and then fully meeting them, has shut out the envidious clamors of the thoughtless. And had Julian and Porphyry given his writings a candid and serious perusal, they would have discoursed on other topics, and not have turned to the framing of blasphemous sophisms. It is also very obvious that the emperor in his discourses was intent on beguiling the ignorant, and did not address himself to those who possess the form of the truth as it is presented in the sacred scriptures. For having grouped together various expressions in which God is spoken of dispensationally, and more according to the manner of men, he thus comments on them. 8. Every one of these expressions is full of blasphemy against God, unless the phrase contains some occult and mysterious sense, which indeed I can suppose. This is the exact language he uses in his third book against the Christians, but in his treatise on the Cynic philosophy, where he shows to what extent fables may be invented on religious subjects, he says that in such matters the truth must be veiled, for, to quote his very words, "Nine, nature loves concealment, and the hidden substance of the gods cannot endure being cast into polluted ears in naked words." From which it is manifest that the emperor entertained this notion concerning the divine scriptures, that they are mystical discourses, containing in them some abstruse meaning. He is also very indignant because all men do not form the same opinion of them, and inveighs against those Christians who understand the sacred oracles in a more literal sense. But it ill became him to rail so vehemently against the simplicity of the vulgar, and on their account to behave so arrogantly towards the sacred scriptures, nor was he warranted in turning with aversion from those things which others rightly apprehended, because forsooth they understood them otherwise than he desired they should. But now, as it seems, a similar cause of disgust seems to have operated upon him to that which affected Porphyry, who, having been beaten by some Christians at Caesarea in Palestine and not being able to endure such treatment, from the working of unrestrained rage renounced the Christian religion, and from hatred of those who had beaten him he took to write blasphemous works against Christians, as Eusebius Pamphilus has proved, who at the same time refuted his writings. So the emperor, having uttered disdainful expressions against the Christians in the presence of an unthinking multitude, through the same morbid condition of mind fell into Porphyry's blasphemies. Since therefore they both willfully broke forth into impiety, they are punished by the consciousness of their guilt. But when Libanius the sophist says 10 in derision, that the Christians make a man of Palestine both God and the Son of God, he appears to have forgotten that he himself has deified Julian at the close of his oration. For they almost killed, says he, the first messenger of his death, as if he had lied against a god. And a little afterwards he adds, "O thou cherished one of the gods, thou disciple of the gods, thou associate en with the gods." Now although Libanius may have meant otherwise, yet inasmuch as he did not avoid the ambiguity of a word which is sometimes taken in a bad sense, he seems to have said the same things as the Christians had done reproachfully. If then it was his intention to praise him, he ought to have avoided equivocal terms, as he did on another occasion, when being criticized he avoided a certain word, cutting it out of his works. Moreover, that man in Christ was united to the Godhead, so that while he was apparently but man, he was the invisible God, and that both these things are most true, the divine books of Christians distinctly teach, but the heathen before they believe, cannot understand. For it is a divine oracle that declares 12 unless ye believe, assuredly ye shall not understand. Wherefore they are not ashamed to place many men among the number of their gods, and would that they had done this, at least to the good, just, and sober, instead of the impure, unjust, and those addicted to drunkenness, like the Hercules, the Bacchus, and the Aesculapius, by whom Libanius does not blush to swear frequently in his orations. And were I to attempt to enumerate the unnatural debaucheries and infamous adulteries of these, the digression would be lengthened beyond measure. But for those who desire to be informed on the subject, Aristotle's Peplum, Dionysius's Corona, Regines's Polymnemon, and the whole host of poets will be enough to show that the pagan theology is a tissue of extravagant absurdities. We might indeed show by a variety of instances that the practice of deifying human beings was far from uncommon among the heathen, nay, that they did so without the slightest hesitation. Let a few examples suffice. The Rhodians having consulted an oracle on some public calamity, a response was given directing them to pay their adoration to Ates, a pagan priest who instituted frantic rites in Phrygia. The oracle was thus expressed: Ates propitiate, the great god, the chaste Adonis, the blessed fair-haired Dionysius rich in gifts. Here Ates, who from an amatory mania had castrated himself, is by the oracle designated as Adonis and Bacchus. Again, when Alexander, king of the Macedonians, passed over into Asia, the Amphictyons courted his favor, and the Pythoners uttered this oracle: To Zeus supreme among the gods, and Athenritogenia pay homage, and to the king divine concealed in mortal form, him Zeus begat in honor to be the protector and dispenser of justice among mortals, Alexander the king. These are the words of the demon at Delphi, who when he wished to flatter potentates, did not scruple to assign them a place among the gods. The motive here was perhaps to conciliate by adulation, but what could one say of the case of Clymedes the pugilist, whom they ranked among the gods in this oracle? The last of the heroes is Clymedes, the Astypalian. Him honor with sacrifices, for he is no longer immortal. Because of this oracle, Diogenes the Cynic, and Enemos the philosopher, strongly condemned Apollo. The inhabitants of Cyzicus declared Hadrian to be the 13th god, and Hadrian himself deified his own catamite Antinous. 13 Libanius does not term these ridiculous and contemptible absurdities, although he was familiar with these oracles, as well as with the work of Adrias on the life of Alexander 14 the pseudo-prophet of Paphlagonia. Nor does he himself hesitate to dignify Porphyry in a similar manner, when after having preferred Julian's books to his, he says, May the Syrian be propitious to me. This digression will suffice to repel the scoffs of the sophist, without following him farther in what he has advanced, for to enter into a complete refutation would require an express work. We shall therefore proceed with our history.